What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham.
Mark Latham. It's Thursday afternoon, and each and every Thursday afternoon we catch up with the leader of One Nation, Mark Latham. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Brent. Always good to be with you.
How are you today?
Pretty good. Going okay. Fortnight break with the Parliament, but some committee inquiries which are interesting, so they keep us busy.
We've got lots to cover today. I want to start with something that isn't on our list, but it is a direct result of a caller from yesterday afternoon's program. His name is John, and John called in with his plight, speaking about his daughter. And he asked me to ask you this afternoon. He's a regular listener to the program, and he loves what you have got to say. He asked me to ask you if you could suggest anything that he could do, or maybe you could do, to help, because he is a desperate man. And as we say, desperate men do desperate things. Let me play you some of the audio from the call yesterday, Mark.
Okay.
Now, I've been on to the local member up here, mate, and there's 48 people waiting for her to get a detox bed at Wyong Detox Centre, and we cannot get it into rehab, mate. And I'm just thinking, mate, there's more important things than the bloody voice. I know this is a biased call because it affects me.
Yeah.
But, mate, her mum and I are just devastated. The whole family's devastated. I know it's personal, but what's going on with the health system, mate, when you can't pick someone up off the street? An ambulance picked her up with the police twice in 3 days, psychotic, suicidal, and we can't get a bed for her anywhere.
This sounds like it's not the first time she's done this either.
No, mate. We can't get her into a detox or a rehabilitation centre. She wants to.
They can't get her into a detox or a rehabilitation centre, Mark. They were told they'd have to wait at least 48 days. And as you can tell, John's at his wit's end and he just doesn't know what to do.
And where does John live?
Wyong.
Okay. Well, his local member there, David Harris, is a minister in the Minns government who should be able to make representations to the health minister to see if an urgent bed can be made available. I'm happy to do that on John's behalf to get the details off air and make representations. But I'd also speak to John about what contact he's had with David Harris there in Wyong, because you'd imagine a minister in the state government would be able to talk to his ministerial colleague Ryan Park, the health minister, and get something done. So if that hasn't happened, it's disappointing, but I'll try and have a go and see if we can get a result.
Thank you, Mark. So John would be listening to us this afternoon. So John, after we finish our conversation with Mark, if you can give us a call here, we'll take your details and pass those details on to Mark, and you can call him and we'll go from there, okay? Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll do our best.
Okay. Let's talk about Anthony Albanese's housing plan. I see a national deal on housing. We'll seek to speed up approvals for property projects that add new homes around major roads and rail routes as state and federal leaders negotiate new ways to boost the supply. The Prime Minister is confident of securing pledges from state premiers to tackle key obstacles to new housing projects, naming zoning laws as a challenge for National Cabinet when it meets next week in Brisbane. It seems as though the Prime Minister is keeping everything he's got crossed that something positive in reference to this housing policy will come out of next week's National Cabinet meeting, Mark.
Well, housing's become the big issue, hasn't it, for owners, would-be owners and renters. The housing crisis is real, and the Albanese government, quite truthfully, is making it worse by going back to big immigration numbers. You just have to wonder, where would we put all the new arrivals that they're planning to take into Australia? But as for zoning and development changes to speed up approvals around rail lines and urban centres, but Brent, we hear this all the time and nothing seems to change. I mean, it's not that hard to cut red tape, to streamline the planning system, to fast track major developments, to get housing units and housing lots up and running, but nothing seems to happen. I mean, just have a look at the Minns government. They've spoken about this. We're waiting in the state parliament now 5 months for some legislation to simplify the Planning Act, and nothing is even on the drawing board. So this is one of the things that frustrates the public, where politics is all talk and no action. you know, we all hope that they get a result in Brisbane next Wednesday, of course. But I'm sceptical, and I just think they lack political will. And I've mentioned on this program a couple of times, but it's such a burning fact that the major property and housing developers in New South Wales tell me they don't invest here anymore because they go to Queensland, where they can get an approval within a couple of months, whereas in New South Wales you wait a couple of years. How hard is it for New South Wales to almost overnight replicate the Queensland system and draw that investment back here to provide the housing supply that's needed to deal with the crisis?
Another stumbling block for the Albanese government seems to be coming to some form of agreement with the Greens. They want a rent freeze for 2 years. The Prime Minister is saying he'll talk to state premiers, and then it's up to the individual states to make a decision based on this. I believe the ACT are the only territory and state in Australia at the moment that has put a freeze on rents. Your thoughts on rent freezing?
Well, the Commonwealth hasn't got the power under the Constitution. It's not clear what states can do, and I don't think it's good policy anyway. I mean, market forces have got to play a role in dealing with these problems. Freezing rents is not a solution. The solution is what I mentioned earlier on, to just get rid of all the red tape, all the delays, all the obstacles to building more housing stock for ownership and for rental. So I don't think a temporary rent freeze is going to achieve much. And what it does, actually, it punishes those who've invested in rental housing stock for the sins of state planning departments that haven't got the supply moving. So if you want to discourage investment, further investment, well, freeze the price. You know, the Greens don't seem to understand these basic economic realities. So I don't see the sense in punishing investors. We need more investment, and they will do it if we fix up the planning laws and fast-track the developments.
Okay, the New South Wales government has lost an appeal against the awarding of $1.5 million to the man wrongly targeted by detectives investigating the disappearance of William Tyrrell. Yesterday, the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal found the maintaining of charges against William Bill Spedding was the worst case of malicious prosecution proved in New South Wales. Mark?
Well, I wanted to talk about this because while everyone's fascinated and obviously very sympathetic to the family and getting to the truth of what happened with William Tyrrell, there has been collateral damage. What happened to Bill Spedding in targeting him, harassing him really, to get him to break under the suspicion that he was guilty, really is a disgrace to the police officers involved, headed by Gary Jubelin. Gary Jubelin gets a lot of good publicity out there, but he owes Bill Spedding a personal apology over this, because Spedding was targeted, obviously, without sufficient evidence. The police have moved on. They don't think it is Spedding, but the man was given publicity and pressure and harassment that made his life an absolute nightmare. He got $1.5 million worth of compensation. And the New South Wales government surprisingly appealed that. I would have thought they should have accepted the original judgment, and they got a shellacking yesterday when the appeal court said it's one of the worst cases of malicious prosecution you'll ever see, and they were sort of indicating maybe the compensation should have been higher. So there's some worries out there, I've got to say. 99% of police officers do a really good job, but boy, when the 1% go off the rails, it's very damaging. But when you see the Spedding case, a seemingly innocent person dealt this way, his life basically destroyed, other than for the financial compensation. You look at the Brittany Higgins case, which we've discussed many times. We used to pride ourselves on the integrity and fairness of our policing and criminal justice system, but boy, there's some really dark clouds out there at the moment.
Mark, a Greens MP has called for cocaine to be legalised in New South Wales. I suppose this comes as a spate of gangland shootings has prompted debate about whether cocaine should be decriminalised or even legalised in New South Wales.
Well, I think it's always useful to remind the public of the silly propositions that come from the Greens. This is the upper house member, Kate Fairman, who wrote in the Sydney Morning Herald, the answer to the gangland shootings is to legalise cocaine. Well, the answer, obviously, is to do something about the shootings, to confiscate guns, to arrest criminals. And if you were in a moment of madness to legalise cocaine, they just move on to a different drug. don't they, and fight their turf wars accordingly, be it ice or something else. So the lack of reality in the Greens saying to legalise cocaine is just so stunning. You know, there are real solutions that are needed to this particular problem, but boy, have you heard of anything more ridiculous than legalising cocaine to stop the criminal gangs firing at each other?
The Minns government has committed to a drug summit, and I see that experts have suggested that decriminalisation is a better option to legalisation of cocaine.
Well, I think the reality is that it seems to be disparaged these days, but the campaign of Just Say No is important. And it starts with marijuana, the argument that a softer drug like marijuana should be legalised or decriminalised in New South Wales. You know, what I worry about, you know, having raised children, having lived in an area that's got a lot of young people, is that a lot of drug taking among the youth is to buck the system, to do the daring thing. So once you legalise a drug like marijuana, or if you moved on to cocaine, they just move on to something more damaging, to buck the system, to be a rebel, to cave in to peer group pressure. So that's why I think it's important to just stand our ground and run the campaign of saying no, urging young people to, you know, I think the reality is they'll experiment to some extent, but experiment in a safe way with softer drugs instead of a legalisation policy that pushes them or dares them to move on to something harder and much more dangerous.
I see it says in the story I was referring to, Mark, that a recent survey of wastewater samples from around the country showed Sydney and New South Wales was the cocaine capital of Australia.
Well, I suppose that's true, but it's not all of Sydney. It seems to be concentrated among well-heeled, wealthier people on the North Shore, the eastern suburbs in particular. It's obviously something that's illegal, but those communities, you know, partake, they keep the trade alive, but we have to stick to law enforcement, don't we? How does it get into the country? Who are the dealers? Who are the crime gangs profiting from this illegal trade? They're all things that I think we need to continue policing.
I see that back in April, when Chris Minns won the election, he was confident of being able to implement his policy agenda, but it seems as though he's hit a few roadblocks, maybe a couple of stop-and-go signs along the way, and is struggling at the moment.
Well, you know, when the state parliament sits, one of the surreal feelings is that the government doesn't have enough legislation to keep the House sitting. Tuesday of last week that happened. The House was collapsed on the Tuesday night because the government had no legislation to bring forward. So there's this weird feeling inside Parliament House that we've got a new government, but there's no new agenda. And I don't know if the public picked that up. I was talking to someone the other day who said, hasn't politics just become mundane and almost boring? The federal government just bangs on about the voice, and that's just so repetitive that most people are bored by it now as they make up their mind. And at state level, the Minns agenda really hasn't got any public excitement or acknowledgement to it. Is there an agenda that this government is pursuing? It's certainly not keeping the parliament active in all those sittings. And we're waiting really, I suppose, for their budget next month to see if they got any major new policies to bring forward in the budget context. Their ministers talk a lot about wait for the budget in September, and I suppose that's what we're doing.
You mentioned the voice. It seems as though overnight there may have been a hint given. I think it was in reference to an address that Tony Abbott was talking about, possibly October 14 is the date for the referendum. We still don't know for sure, but the Prime Minister said something between the football and the Melbourne Cup, so Saturday, October 14 is looking like it could be the date that we actually finally go to the polls for the voice referendum.
Yeah, it seems strange that we've had so much talk about it, but no date in which the voting would take place. I think most people who listen to politics have heard enough. They want to get on with it. You know, let's do the vote and see where the numbers fall. It's my expectation, though, you look at the polls now that are consistently showing the yes votes dropping like a stone, and I'm expecting this to fail in every state and probably drop below 40% of the primary vote nationwide, which it does follow the trend of past referenda proposals that as people think more about them, they grow more sceptical, the government explanations become vaguer and less satisfactory, and the yes vote drops over time. But this thing is dropping like a stone, and it'll be interesting, you know, if my prediction is true, they're absolutely shellacking for the government in putting this forward, what implications it has for Albanese in his leadership and the government's future. Because he's invested so much in it. I mean, you've never seen a new government invest so much in a single referendum proposition. But if it goes down badly, then it's going to have other major implications.
What's your take on all the talk over the last probably, you know, 48 hours about the Uluru Statement from the Heart? Albanese's been telling us all it's an A4 page, but it's come to light in recent times. I think Peter Credlin takes credit for part of that with the Freedom of Information release of the complete Uluru Statement from the Heart. It is. It's 26 pages, not just a single A4 page.
Yeah, I've always thought it was a much longer document. I remember when they released it publicly, it was a longer document, and the single page at the front was like a summary page, if you like, a précis. So I think that's always been the format for it. And the surprising thing about the last election campaign, when Albanese was walking around saying Labor's committed to the implementation of the Uluru Statement in full, there wasn't a lot of focus on, well, what does in full mean? What does the full document actually say with regard to a treaty, with the so-called Orwellian Truth Commission, with reparations, compensation? All of these things really weren't dealt with at the election campaign, and everyone's been catching up ever since. But my impression's always been a longer document with a one-page summary.
You and I haven't talked about COVID in a long time, but there is a new coronavirus strain. It's nicknamed Eris, E-R-I-S, they say it's unlikely to cause a new wave of infection in Australia. That's what the experts are hoping, Mark.
Well, one of the funny things about the ABC is the way they always, they're sort of like the last Japanese soldiers on the Pacific Islands. Nobody told them that the war is over. This Eris is being pumped up by the ABC as some big new threat. We should still take COVID seriously. When you go back to all the hysteria, particularly those so-called experts who were predicting doom and gloom and huge numbers of Australians dying, hundreds of thousands and the like, it really was a wave of media and academic hysteria, the like of which we really haven't seen before. And there are some of the last soldiers are left still running this line. But, you know, quite truthfully, the public has moved on. And, you know, I know a fair number of people move around the city. The number of masks now is minuscule. The number of people talking about COVID, you know, almost non-existent. And among all the people I know, it's very hard to find anyone now, even in these winter months, who's got COVID. So, you know, Eris or some other strain that comes forward, I think the sensible thing is for everyone to get back to normal and stay normal, rather than falling for ABC-inspired hysteria about something where, by and large, we've just all moved on.
Just before I let you go, quick comment. We've got the Matildas taking on France on Saturday night. It's the quarterfinal. The Prime Minister this week was hinting that if they win the World Cup, we'll have a public holiday. We took calls and, gee, didn't make a lot of people happy, particularly small business people.
Well, yeah, I think a public holiday has got to be planned and slotted in so that business, with all due respect, you know, business, we mentioned COVID, business has been to hell and back through the COVID period. Do they need a public holiday where they've got to pay penalty rates to stay open or most likely close down and lose that revenue? So everyone's cheering on the Matildas. Sure, there's nothing better than the home team doing well in a World Cup competition of any kind. And this team, you know, an outstanding set of results over the last couple of games. They've sort of captured the public imagination. But I don't think there's need for a spontaneous public holiday. You know, maybe replicate what Hawke said after we won the America's Cup in 1983. If the workers don't turn up because they're out late, don't sack them. You know, if you sack them, you're a bum.
Yeah.
I think that's the way to go rather than a public holiday. So Albanese should listen to the small business sector and also acknowledge that, yeah, some people might not turn up to work that day because they're out celebrating a Matildas win. And if they get through France in a semi-final against England, that will be mega huge, and then on to the final. So a lot of excitement ahead if our national team can keep on winning.
Fingers crossed for Saturday. Always good to catch up with you, mate. Thank you for your time. We'll talk to you next Thursday.
A pleasure. Thanks, Brent.
Thank you, Mark.